Welcome to the Gay Buddhist Forum, where teachers from all schools of Buddhism offer their perspectives on the Dharma and its application in modern times, especially for LGBTQI audiences. These talks are offered freely to the world and made possible by appreciative listeners. If you would like to support our efforts to share the Dharma with underserved audiences, please visit gaybuddhist.org. There you can donate, find a list of upcoming speakers, or enjoy many hundreds of these recorded talks dating back to 1996.
Welcome back to the Gay Buddhist Fellowship. Our tradition is to go around and introduce ourselves first, and then I'll introduce the speaker. My name is Tom.
I'm Kay.
Jeremy.
I'm George.
Jim.
Don.
Paul.
Silas.
My name is Prasad Achitta.
Edwin.
I'm Greg.
Andre. My name is Juan.
I'm Alter.
My name is Mark.
Yes.
My name is Michael.
I'm David.
I'm Jack.
I'm Brad.
Peter.
My name is Ray.
Jeff.
My name is Jerry.
Yeah, I'm John.
My name is Brian.
Jose.
Jim.
My name is Roy.
I'm David.
I'm Richard.
Ethan.
My name is Joe.
My name is Richard.
I'm Hal.
I'm Clint.
Kirk.
Donald.
I'm Terry.
Did we miss anyone?
No.
And just by a show of hands, I forgot, anybody here just for the first time? Welcome, welcome. So maybe we could, so it's Edwin, Jeremy, Stephen, Terry. Welcome, we'll try and remember your names. I have the pleasure of introducing our good friend Dale Borgel. Dale is the founder and the executive director of the Living Dying Project. He's a pioneer in the conscious dying movement and has worked directly with thousands of people with life-threatening illness and their families for over 30 years. In 1981, Dale founded the first residential facility for people who wish to die consciously in the United States, the Dying Center. He has taught and lectured extensively on the topics of spiritual support for those with life-threatening illness, caregiving as a spiritual practice, and healing at the edge of illness, of death, of loss, of crisis. Dale has a BS from UC Berkeley and a PhD from Stanford University. He is the co-author of Journey of Awakening, a Meditator's Guidebook, and has taught meditation for the past 35 years. Dale, welcome.
Thank you, Tom. So nice to see so many old friends and some hopefully new ones. At the beginning of the new year, New Year's Eve is actually my favorite holiday. It's a time to start over, forget about all those things I've done in the past, and have a clean slate. I'd like to talk today about the heart of Buddhism. There is a very famous scripture in Buddhism called the Prajnaparamita Sutra, or the Heart Sutra. And in the Heart Sutra, it says, there is neither tainted nor pure. Let's think about that for a second. We think of the Dalai Lama. He seems like he's pure. I'm sure it's not too hard to think of somebody who you think of as not being pure. Donald Trump, your neighbor. How can we understand what the Heart Sutra is saying? There is neither tainted nor pure. There is a Buddhist meditation teacher in India who said, the mind creates the abyss, the heart crosses it. So when we look at the comparison between Donald Trump and the Dalai Lama, or between somebody you really care about and somebody you don't like too much, if we look at them with our minds, there is a difference. But when we look through our hearts, it is possible with a different set of eyes to see the place in which the Dalai Lama and Donald Trump are the same. Everybody just introduced themselves. There seem to be a lot of Davids and Richards, and but anyway, there are different people in the room, older, younger, bigger, smaller, more hair, less hair. Looking with those eyes, we see the differences. And very often, with our judging mind, we see the tainted. We see how we aren't approving of how we or somebody else is behaving. At times, maybe right after meditation, or you've been out in nature, or you've just heard a perfect piece of music, you can look and you don't see those differences. You see with eyes where everyone really looks beautiful. Another thing that is said in the Heart Sutra is that form is emptiness and emptiness is form. Also, form is form and emptiness is emptiness. But what does it mean that form is emptiness? There are three qualities to the open heart. And one of them is the quality of emptiness. And by emptiness, we don't mean that nothing is there. What we mean is that I am not there. So that with the heart, we often start out working with the heart as a dualistic practice. I am cultivating compassion for other. I am feeling love for other. But when we go deeply enough into the heart, when we go deeply enough into emptiness, then the I who is experiencing the love or the compassion or the equanimity begins to fall away. So that really a quality that is probably not talked too much about in Buddhism, really what we're talking about here is surrender. Can we surrender into the heart? Much of Buddhism is about becoming present, cultivating awareness or mindfulness. My first meditation teacher, Suzuki Roshi, has a wonderful quote. He said, "Life is like stepping into a boat that is about to sail out to sea and sink." And if we look at life as about to sink, our life about to sink into the sea from the mind, it's very frightening. We try to control. We try to make sure that we've got a life preserver. But if we can trust that the heart will allow us to float through those sinking moments, then possibly we can set sail with a different attitude. Suzuki Roshi also said, the most important thing is finding the most important thing. So maybe here at the beginning of the year, we can all think of, what is the most important thing for you? What is not your heart's desire, but your heart of hearts, in your deepest heart, what is it that you really want? And I would guess that for most people, it does have something to do with the heart, that your heart opens so that you connect more with those you love, you connect more with your own self, you connect more with the sacred. And trusting that quality of emptiness really is, for many of us, a long, gradual path. I've done a lot of Vipassana practice, I've done a lot of Zen practice, I've done a lot of Tibetan Buddhist practice. But really, if I'm honest enough, all of that is in a way preparation for trusting my heart. I began practice because I wasn't happy. I, as Tom mentioned, I have a PhD from Stanford. Well, I have a PhD in mathematics, and that was not a happy-making process for me, as you could maybe guess. And at the same time then, so I started meditating because my mind was all locked up in categorizing, fixing, structuring, managing the way that a mathematically trained mind would do. And I meditated enough that I wasn't so unhappy anymore. My ego structure became more efficient. I wasn't having bad dreams anymore. I liked people better. They seemed to like me at least a little better. And at that point, my practice got kind of stale. I stopped practicing because I had found what I was looking for, not being overwhelmed by suffering on a daily basis. But at that point, I began to notice that even though I was a little happier and I had a more efficient ego structure, that I wasn't really connecting with people in a way that I would like to. Occasionally, through serendipity, I would fall in love or I would meet somebody and something would happen. But I had a really deep intuitive sense that there was another way of meeting people. Before I mentioned that there were three qualities of the open heart. The first one was the empty or spacious heart, the heart that is not filled with I. The second quality of the open heart is the warm heart, the heart that feels warm regardless of the circumstance. And the third quality of the open heart is the connected heart. Rumi said, grief is the garden of compassion. Grief is any emotion arising in response to feeling separate. Compassion is having the quality of feeling connected. So one way we could talk about our spiritual practice is transmuting the feelings of feeling disconnected or separate into being connected. That can't be done with the mind. Because with the mind, we're going to see the tainted. We're going to look around and see how people are behaving badly, how people are lazy, how people are arrogant, how we ourselves are selfish. We will see those things with the mind. These things are part of the human condition. But I believe that the reason we're sitting here in this room together is to find those eyes of compassion, that heart of compassion, that can see the place where not only do we have different people in the room, but there's just one heart. There's just one being. There's just one consciousness. In a fundamental sense, life is nothing other than consciousness meeting one experience after the other, after the other. And usually we identify with the separateness. I'm the person who is being aware of that. I'm the person who's being aware of right now the sound of my own voice. So I'm the subject, or sometimes we're identifying with the object. I'm the anger that you're aware of. But what we're really saying here is that we are the consciousness that is experiencing things. You're not the subject, you're not the object, the consciousness itself. Now, there are two main paths in spirituality, the path of wisdom, inquiry, of understanding how things are, just consciousness meeting experience. The other path is the path of devotion. And trying to find wholeness through surrender to the unmanifest or the absolute, I find a very difficult one. I find that without bringing the heart into the path, it's a very steep and difficult path. But that bringing the quality of heart into my own practice so that when I sit down and I meditate and it's one of those days where there's a lot of thoughts, the mind is jagged, the body is restless, the body is tired. Is the mind saying, oh, you're not doing well, you're failing? Or on the other hand, is the heart saying, yes, Dale, I can even love, I can even have compassion for the part of you that isn't meditating in the way that matches up with your ideal. Today is the day of Suzuki Roshi quotes. And he said, after Zazen, after meditation, we bow to the floor 9 times. By bowing, we are giving up ourselves. To give up ourselves means to give up our dualistic ideas. There is no difference between Zazen practice and bowing. Usually to bow means to pay our respects to something which is more worthy of respect than ourselves. But when you bow to Buddha, you should have no idea of Buddha. You just become one with Buddha. You are already Buddha himself. When you become one with Buddha, one with everything that exists, you find the true meaning of being. When you forget all your dualistic ideas, everything becomes your teacher and everything can be the object of worship. I sat with Suzuki Roshi many, many times. He never mentioned love. He never talked about the heart. But he was one of the most loving people I'd ever met. When he laughed, it sounded like a bubbling brook. It was one of the sweetest sounds you could imagine. His practice was to sit still and face the wall with your eyes open for many, 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 many hours. And in that looking, eventually we see that the mind is changing. One of the basic tenets of Buddhism is impermanence. There's a moment of hearing, there's a moment of seeing, there's a moment of thinking, on and on and on, always changing. What is it that is not changing moment to moment? What is it that's constant when we look from face to face or hear all the different names in the room here? It's easy to see the differences. It's easy to see the differences out there. It's easy to see the differences of our internal experience. But is there something that doesn't change? So that when there was silence for a few moments, what remained? When there wasn't the sound of my voice, what is it that remains? And what Buddhism actually says is that we're not just connected, we are one. We are one in Buddha, we are one in the heart. In Buddhism, there are what are called the four heavenly abodes, the Brahma-viharas, loving-kindness, compassion, equanimity, and joy. These are qualities that are done as concentration exercises, not something we're mindful of, but actually in monastic settings usually, people sit down and concentrate on the feeling of loving-kindness for days, weeks at a time, or the feeling of compassion. Most of us don't have time to sit down and do that for days or weeks at a time. But is it possible to take part of your life and make loving kindness, or make compassion, or make joy, or make equanimity a focus of compassion, so that you work with the quality of the heart? Like right now, what is the quality of your heart? Do you feel connected? Do you feel connected to me? Do you feel connected to yourself? Do you feel connected to the room? Do you feel a warm heart? Do you feel a spacious heart? Is there a lot of I who's mixed up there in your heart? Interestingly, these wonderful qualities, these heavenly abodes, have near and far enemies. And when one understands them, I think it makes it easier to do this practice. So the far enemy of loving kindness, to no surprise, is hatred. Who would like to guess what the near enemy of loving kindness is? It looks like loving kindness. You could see somebody doing this, you might think they're being loving, but they're not.
Attachment.
Attachment, correct. So you fall in love, as an example, one of the most obvious examples. Are you really feeling love or are you feeling attachment? Very likely, it is a very complicated mixture of the two. Attachment wants something in return. Love asks nothing in return. So that this quality of asking nothing in return is not something that we can really do until we've created the foundation of being grounded, being centered, doing that practice that Suzuki Roshi taught of just being present. Until we are mindful, until we have a strong foundation of mindfulness, it will be very difficult, if not impossible, to begin to open the heart in the way that we're talking about today. The far enemy of compassion is indifference. I don't care if you're suffering. The near enemy is pity. So we see somebody suffering. Are we feeling sorry for them, or does their heart really open? We still feel equal to them. Not, in fact, the Dalai Lama says one of the defining qualities of compassion is the ability to equalize and switch yourself with somebody else. If I feel better than you or less than you in any moment, in that moment, compassion becomes impossible. So compassion doesn't necessarily make suffering go away, but it makes it bearable, it makes it meaningful. From the standpoint of the mind, we will see suffering wherever we look. As I was driving here today, coming down South Van Ness, there's just piles of garbage on the sidewalk. There's a guy sleeping next to a pile of garbage. It was lightly raining. And the mind wonders what's going to happen to this poor guy. I can feel pity for him. It's easy to separate myself, to say, okay, he's there, I'm in my nice, warm car that has heated seats, right? It's coming up, right? My butt is feeling very comfortable. He's out there in the rain. I can feel sorry. But can I really, instead, go into my heart and feel connected with him, and even beyond that, feel one with him? His suffering is my suffering. His joy is my joy. Maybe he's got more joy than I do. I don't even know. But the tendency is to pull back, to defend ourselves from the suffering of another human being. In Orthodox Christianity, they talk about letting the mind drop into the heart, so that we still keep thinking, but each thought is colored by the mind. It's as if you're dyeing a piece of cloth. I was in India with this fellow Maharaji who Jeff knows too, and Ram Dass's guru, some of you may know about him. And I was sitting with Maharaji with a friend of mine named Mohan and a bunch of Indian people, and Maharaji said to Mohan, how much do you pay for milk in America? And Mohan made a quick calculation. And he said, X number of rupees per kilo. And Maharaj said, my God, can you believe that? And he turned to the Indians. And he was saying, they paid so much money for milk in America. And he was going on and on and on, talking about how much Americans have to pay for milk. And he turned to Mohan again and said, how much was it again? And Mohan did that. And he went on and on and on. And I just got my PhD. I just got into India, and I was thinking, what's going on here? I mean, why are we talking about the price of milk in America? I've come all the way to India. Maybe this guy isn't who I thought he was. And at that moment, this thunderbolt came into my mind that was, I can't describe how, but I knew came from him. And what he revealed to me was, we can talk about important things, but that just busies up the mind. Let's talk about trivial things so that we can then rest in this ocean of love and bliss. And that moment, this bliss opened up into my heart that remained for the rest of the day. So right now, I can keep trying to talk about clever things, and I should be doing that for about 20 more minutes. So I will do my best. But at the same time, is your mind getting busy? Are you getting lost in your mind because I'm saying interesting things, or maybe you're judging me because they're not interesting enough? Or in this moment, can we be together in our one heart, regardless of the content? And in fact, maybe the more boring the content is, the easier it is to go beyond the differences of moment to moment to moment and rest in that which does not change. So that as we get better at doing that, practice ceases being something that takes effort. It's something we rest in. And as long as there is an I who is trying to meditate better or become a better person, we are 180 degrees from the truth, because there is no I. It is a delusion. Kala Rinpoche, the Dalai Lama's meditation teacher, said, and it's my favorite quote of all time, we live in illusion and the appearance of things. There is a reality, with a capital R, There is a reality. We are that reality. Knowing this, we see that we are everything. And being everything, we are nothing. That is all. So we're everything in the sense that I am you and you are me, and we're nothing in the sense that there isn't really an I who is separate. Before I plunge on, are there any remarks or questions at this point? Yeah, please.
You remind what I'm hearing from whatever it is that is you.
Thank you.
I've held on to some scientific evidence that in the Genome Project that they're tracking something like 300 trillion organisms or cells that comprise whatever this is that is this. And I continue to hold on to that in mind, especially to free whatever this is up of that I. It kind of puts things in perspective that there never really was an I. In fact, there's a whole bunch of. And then there's an essence. So, and Dale, when you said, what's left for me, it's what I recognize is it's the essence. That's what I come here for. That essence gets mixed and connected in here. Thanks for reminding me.
Thank you. In some way, I think that essential quality is much easier to find in a group than it is alone. We live in a culture that is actually trying to convince us of the illusion. And the work of the Dharma is going against a very strong current of our society. The Buddha's nephew Ananda came to the Buddha and said, "Oh Buddha, I've heard that the Sangha, being with other seekers, is half of the spiritual path." And the Buddha said, Oh no, Ananda, it is all of the path. Being with others who are on the path is all of the path. And I think a lot of that has to do with the heart. I feel that a bit awkward because I'm really not a Buddhist. I've done a lot of Buddhist practice to try to recover from being a mathematician. And I'm really more of a devotional person. And yet, I really do think that at the foundation of Buddhism, it is about the heart. It is about going into the mind, becoming present so fully that the heart is revealed. And yet we live in what is primarily a Judeo-Christian culture that is a devotional culture. And in my humble opinion, there are very few people that I have met who are Westerners, who are fully out-and-out Buddhists, that they're coming to Buddhism a way of often healing the wounds that have been inflicted upon them by one church or synagogue or temple or another. And Carl Jung said that to become a fully integrated person, one must go back to the religion of one's childhood, which is a rather frightening notion, I think, for a lot of us. But I don't think it means you have to go back to Lutheran church, in my case, or Catholic or church or whatever it might be in somebody else's case. But that go back to the essential quality of what was in our hearts as a child. And the essence of Judeo-Christianity is about love. In fact, that's the essence of all religions. So I've been giving sort of a pep talk here for the heart of Buddhism, going into your heart. How would one go about doing that? There is a practice I've suggested of concentrating on the feeling of loving kindness. One could, instead of being with your breath down here, one, or being with your breath here in your nostrils, not in your belly or in your nostrils, but be in your breath in your heart. Breathe in love. Breathe out spaciousness. Breathe in compassion. Breathe out spaciousness. There's another practice called Guru Yoga in Tibetan Buddhism, where you imagine in front of you a being of radiant golden light, the Buddha, the Christ, Shiva, the mother, whatever appeals to you. If you're not religious in that sense, it could be just a generic being of light. And you imagine this being right in front of you, and you begin to imagine what it would feel like to be sitting in front of the Buddha, the embodiment of wisdom and compassion. What would that feel like? And out of the heart of the Buddha comes into you a beam of golden light that purifies you of any obscurations. So right now, there he is. It's not just a statue. This is actually the Buddha there. Can we feel his radiant nature? And out of his heart comes a beam of radiant golden light that purifies you of anything that you imagine in your delusion that is preventing you from realizing your nature. And gradually, your solid body, of all those how many trillion, 300 trillion cells or whatever it is, begins to be transmuted into cells of radiant golden light, so that you and I and we together are made out of exactly the same substance as the Buddha. There is absolutely no difference between your essential nature and that of the Buddha. And then very gradually, you and I merge into his body. There is just one body of this radiant light. And we rest there. And then when the mind complains and says, wait a minute, you're neurotic. You aren't the Buddha. He's trying to talk you into something here. In that moment, you notice that thought, and you realize that even that thought, even that complaining thought, even that neurotic thought is a pure expression of your Buddha nature. Going back to the Prajnaparamita Sutra, there is neither tainted nor pure. So if you think of the thing that you did in 2015, the most embarrassing thing you did, or the thing you wished you hadn't done, you treated somebody unkindly, or you did something in secret that you wouldn't want anybody to know about, and you realize that that's neither tainted nor pure. It's just an expression of your Buddha nature. There's nothing to improve, nothing to fix, nothing to understand, nothing to get. And in my humble opinion, and don't tell anybody I said this, that the purpose of practice is you practice enough that you realize that there's no point to practice, that there's nothing to achieve. So you can still keep sitting, but it's not going to get you anywhere. Your mind will become calmer, but a calm mind and a restless mind, they're equally Buddha nature. There's no distinction. Now, there are all these teachers who go on saying things like that. Krishnamurti was selected as a child to be the next avatar, and he was trained and trained, and then he finally said, I'm not the avatar. And he became a teacher, and he got very frustrated that he would say there's nothing to achieve, and he got frustrated that his students couldn't understand there's nothing to achieve. And there's a lot of non-dual teachers running around the Bay Area saying, you're enlightened already, there's nothing to get. And they're frustrated that people can't get that there's nothing to get. But that they're saying that after they worked really hard to get something. Right? Adyashanti did many years of Zen practice before he said, hey, there's nothing to do. Okay, so is there a way, is there maybe a way of going to the heart deeply enough that we don't have to sit till our knees fall off? We don't have to bow till we get calluses on our foreheads. That there's a surrender into the heart. How deeply do you trust the heart? In Buddhism, when we begin to practice, when we begin a day-long meditation or a longer practice period, people take refuge. I take refuge in the Buddha, I take refuge in the Dharma, I take refuge in the Sangha. For the second time, I take refuge in the Buddha. For the second time, I take refuge in the Dharma. For the second time, I take refuge in the Sangha. For the third time, I take refuge in the Buddha. For the third time, I take refuge in the Sangha. For the third time, I take refuge in the Dharma. Maybe I did those out of order there at the end. Okay, if we really take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, practice is done. If you really take refuge in the fact that freedom exists, the Buddha exists in this moment, not the historical guy, but the essential nature of liberation, Buddhahood. If you really take refuge in the Dharma, that there is a way, and Dharma means many different things, but there's the path of Dharma and there is the wisdom of Dharma, and you take refuge in us together. If you really do that, you're done. The tricky part about the heart is that, at least in my experience, my heart is almost always partly open and partly closed. And I work with my heart and it gets 20% more open than it used to be, and I feel, oh, now my heart is open, this is great. But do we really go to that place beyond the 20%, beyond the 20%? In Hasidim, there is a poem that says, when you sit down to pray, when you kneel down to pray, pray with such a heart that you're willing to die during that prayer, so that the person who's there at the end is not the person who's there when it started. We all walked in this room at 10:30 or so this morning. We're going to be leaving in about 20 minutes. Is the person who's going to walk out that door in 20 minutes the same guy that walked in the door an hour and a half ago or whatever it is? There is some continuity. You have pretty much the same clothes on. Your hair is going to be the same color. The same neurotic structures are going to be there. But what are you going to be identifying with? Are you those neurotic structures? Are you that body that has all those trillions of cells? Or are you the essential quality of the heart? Other remarks or questions? Please.
In your example, you said, you know, go back in 2015 and pick the most embarrassing thing that you've thought of doing, and saying that's the same as, if I'm getting it right, that's the same as a pure act. I can kind of get that, but at the same time, where does ethical behavior fit into that?
That's a good question. So, understanding that it's all Buddha nature is not a license to act irresponsibly. The fact that the more we understand it's all Buddha nature, the more we become compassionate. Okay, so the three qualities of the awakened mind, the fully awakened mind, are clarity, that you're right there with whatever is happening, emptiness of self, there's not a self doing it anymore, and compassion activity that's arising. So I will agree that there is a danger here, and there are teachers who think they have some taste of enlightenment, and they go around fornicating and scamming money and doing all kinds of things because they've gotten a taste of that, and they use that taste for their ego's ends. But eventually the Dharma protects itself, so that the more you go into your heart and realize that even an action done out of fear or arrogance and an action done out of altruism are neither tainted nor pure equally, the more that will bring you to acting ethically and in the best interests of all beings. That you cannot act selfishly when you begin, because the deeper we go into practice, we become one being. There is interdependence. And the suffering of the person next to you, in the Bible it talks about loving your neighbor, and actually the Aramaic word is not the guy who lives next door to you, but the person who's actually next to you. Love your neighbor, that the more you go into practice, you have to love the person next to you. That's because that's what your nature is. God is love. Your nature is love. Your nature is whole. It's untainted. It's not a straight path. I mean, there will be some confusion along the way, to be sure. But the less we judge ourselves, one of the major impediments to the spiritual path is the superego, the judging mind. So for you to judge yourself for that thing you did last year and say, okay, I'm not a good human being, that just slows down the whole process of realizing who you truly are.
I want to offer something on the triangle at back. So this is very important for my path. So there was nothing that I could have done any differently than I did. Everything that I did was exactly what I could have done. That was it. And to echo back to Dale, it was the best that I could do at the time. And in that respect, it supports this. There wasn't a bad, there wasn't a good, it just was. So it's a different lens to put on that removes the superego and allows just this flow of acknowledgement. Nothing could have happened differently than it did. And actually science will back that up. It's impossible for anything to have been different than it was.
Well, I think I could have made other choices besides, I mean, one example would be back crudely or you know, in a way that was selfish or arrogant. I had choices to do something different besides that action.
You may have had choices, but the choices that were made at the time, that's what was made, and nothing could have happened differently than it did. And that's, you know, it's impossible for anything to be anything other than what it was. And knowing that, it allows one to move to the next moment without interest in trying to make something different about things that have already completed, and without judgment.
So we're kind of getting into here the meaning of karma, which is the Buddha said trying to understand karma is one of the four things that can unhinge the mind. And rather than try to understand how, is there a choice or not? Is there free will? In the last 3 minutes here, I'd rather move on. That's okay. Anybody else?
Thank you, Dale. It seems to me that one of the reasons for practice is that very realization that the Buddha taught, that everything is impermanent. And because we are embodied in this 3 trillion cell organism, that factor of constant change means that, for me, practice is like tuning up the engine, readjusting in some way my organism's relationship to everything. And it is a source of refuge because it is the ultimate tool.
Yeah. When I say there's no, I mean, I certainly agree that practice is very useful. And from an absolute standpoint, there's nothing to attain. From a relative standpoint, to keep tuning up the engine is a good thing to do. But to realize that you're not practicing to get something, to fix something, but to just be doing what you're doing, I think takes a lot of the self-judgment and the confusion out of the way we at least approach practice in the beginning.
And another aspect is lifting off the cushion and continuing the practice,
right,
in whatever you do.
In fact, many teachers say that the most important part of the meditation period is the the most important part of meditation practice is the post-meditation period. The bell rings, and do we immediately then shift back into conditioned mind, action, reaction, action, reaction? Or can we bring that spaciousness, that loving kindness, and integrate it into our daily life? If practice is only something that's taking place on the cushion, then what's really the point? Anybody else?
One more question. You said you follow the devotional path. What does that mean?
Well, usually we think of as devotion to something outside of ourselves. I run something called the Living Dying Project. And in fact, I'd encourage you to go to our website, livingdying.org. And in fact, out on the big square coffee table, there's a bunch of these flyers where I facilitate ongoing small groups. One of them here is in the Mission District on Monday nights, and Tom and Roy and Jim, at one point, were all in that group. They've all graduated, but you can see how it worked out for them. Maybe you don't want to join after all. But as Tom sort of implied during the introduction, I work with dying people. And so one aspect of my devotion is serving other people. Mother Teresa, who I'm not at all comparing myself to, I assure you, I'm not Mother Teresa in drag. Mother Teresa, when she would pick a leper out of the gutter in Calcutta, said she was seeing Christ in his distressing disguise. So I work with dying people. And Trungpa Rinpoche said that until you come in intimate contact with death, your spiritual practice will have the quality of being a dilettante. And I really believe that having a strong contemplative practice combined with an intimate relationship with death is the best practice for this troubled and confusing age that we live in. I am kind of taking a detour from your question. Devotion starts out as I'm devoted to something outside of myself, a teacher, a teaching, a group. But eventually we begin to find, just in the way I've been suggesting during this talk, that what I'm devoted to is not something separate from self. That in the beginning I invoke the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, or I invoke Maharaji, or I invoke the Mother. And as practice deepens, I realize that what I'm devoted to is in no way separate from who I fundamentally am or who you are. And it's that place where we are one that I am devoted to. I think that's probably a nice place to bring this to an end. Thank you so much. Thank you all.
Thank you, Dale. Next week, our speaker will be Dhammachari Dhanadasa, who has been practicing with the San Francisco Buddhist Center, where we are today, since 1993 and was ordained in 2011.
Thank you for listening to the Gay Buddhist Forum. If you would like to hear several new talks per month and be notified of upcoming speakers so you can participate live, please subscribe to this podcast, like us on Facebook, and join our mailing list by visiting gaybuddhist.org.